afternoon. Shall we talk about?
What maybe is the motivation of somebody who is very ill to choose to?
Who is what?
Very ill.
Mm-hmm.
To choose to have to carry.
Mm. I don't know because I'm not in that position. In the case this morning, it was a renewal of vows. It was not a first time. And people do that sometimes. They renew their vows, even when they're not ill. Mm-hmm. So even when they are not ill, mm-hmm. I've known people who've done that. I don't really know. I didn't ask Myoji why she was doing it. But as Roshi pointed out, she began by thanking Myoji for doing it, because everyone who's participating in the ceremony is renewing their vows at the same time. So that's a way of looking at it too.
Can it help for to face the illness, to face the proximity of death, to face the unknown?
Maybe. I don't know. We'd have to ask them, Myoji. I think that her practice and maybe the process of making the rakusu and everything, I don't know, has been very important for her in her life until this point, but now at this point as well.
Do you do a new one for a new chukai?
She did. She renewed and she made a new rakusu. She, however, had not done her first time with Gena Roshi. She had done it with another teacher. So this was the first time with Roshi, but it was the second time. And she was given another name this time too.
Oh, you can change names.
She got a new name. However, probably she could use both of them. You know, sometimes they have two names. Theoretically, when I became a Roshi, I should have received another name. So then I would have two names, you know, but she didn't do that. But her second name, I don't know what Myoji means, although she told me, I can't remember. But it's a Japanese word.
Myoji is her first Dharma name?
Yes.
Yes.
It's interesting. Someone else said that to me too today. They didn't know that. Mm. That was her Dharma name. Mm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I
didn't know that.
It was
a name. No. Mm-hmm. No, her real name is Nasim Khan. Her first name is Nasim, and her last name is Khan. And her father was Indian, Muslim Indian. And I think she was raised Muslim, actually.
Muslim?
Yeah, I think. Someone told me today that she once had not come to a retreat because she was doing Ramadan. So, I don't know.
Hmm? Her mother?
No. Someone today,
oui.
Quelqu'un aujourd'hui
oui.
m'a dit que une fois quand il est venu à une retraite, elle n'est pas venue parce qu'elle faisait le Ramadan.
Donc elle serait pratiquante Ramadan.
Je ne savais pas. Anyway, so but the new name she and so she has used since she received her name Myoji, which in some sanghas is very common that you use your people use their dharma names. Once you receive Jukai, then that's your name in the sangha, and that's how everyone knows you.
Probably easier with a Japanese name.
Exactly.
Than with a Yusuf.
That's what we've always said.
The smaller Japanese usually it's.
Yeah, I mean, it can be something like, you know, penetrating the intimate silence of primordial beauty or something, but it's just Jin-san or, you know, something like so. Whereas ours, yeah, if we do it in English or in French or something, it's. So, right, the name she received today is Unborn Awareness. So, she probably will not be called Myoji Unknown, Unborn Awareness, but who knows? It was interesting that there was awareness in there, given that we had talked about this, huh? That we had talked about this.
Unborn.
And unborn, yeah. Exactly. What is it? Well, what is not born does not die.
Yeah, that's it.
And awareness is not born and doesn't die. And Roshi gave a little talk about awareness and how it's our nature. And what I was saying yesterday, you are it. You know, you are the universe, you are that. Was that yesterday or Friday? I don't remember. Yeah.
Unborn awareness reminded me of Lada's name, Lada's Dharma name, original face.
Original face, yeah.
The original, because the original face, and you talked about that yesterday, the context of where that comes from, mm-hmm. the original face. What was your original face before your parents were born, or something mm-hmm. like that? Mm-hmm.
So what is unborn awareness? The same thing. Yeah. You know, I think maybe that, of course, I'm not in that position, so I can't say, but I can understand that maybe people, when they are confronted with the end of their life, turn to some sort of spiritual guide or practice or something. To make sense of what's happening, maybe in a way, but also to connect with what doesn't, to maybe have an experience of what doesn't die. Obviously, there, because I think we have some sense somewhere that this is ending, but there's something else that we just that's mysterious that we don't know. You know, and if it's in a Christian tradition, and there's the soul that is eternal, and maybe that can be of some comfort. I don't know, but also connecting with the unborn awareness could also be of comfort, maybe, or freeing from the constraints of how we think, what we think is life and what we think is death. So, I don't know.
Is it that much different from you're talking about looking for some kind of religious, so to say, some spiritual context, some to make sense of to make sense of what's happening or what we think or know what will be happening, or to look for comfort. But that also happens a lot, not when we are about to die, when we go through a difficult experience of someone who died, for instance, or something that was difficult for us, and we also look, may look that might also happen.
It's true.
Actually, it was interesting because I thought about this before today. When I had an interview with, it wasn't actually an actual interview with Gana Roshi 3 years ago in Portugal. That was one of my problems at the time. I was a bit unsure about. Because how I got to know Buddhism and meditation practice and all that was in a very difficult period of my life, and I always had this kind of uncomfortable at times. Is this really true for me, or did I just look for something like this because I was going through a bad period? And when sometimes I felt like this, I was afraid. It was not that I was uncertain, I was afraid to find that I wasn't truly in this practice, that it had just been looking for some kind of comfort. I was afraid I was afraid if I would find that. I talked to Gana Roshi about this. I talked with a friend of mine in Portugal, Antonio, I think. And he told me this very beautiful thing, Oh no, on the contrary, it's exactly the opposite. Because when you are suffering, or when you are really in need, that's when you are most true to yourself. So it kind of turned it around. And then Gana Roshi, she kind of said the same thing, because she made a reference to her own personal experience of her own. A difficult thing, and in which she found this Buddhism and all this, and so I kind of connected the two things, and it's interesting when you have someone, you are fortunate enough to have someone that makes you look at it's completely the opposite. No, you're not being untrue. You should not be afraid of finding that you are being untrue to yourself or to this practice. You are being No, you are really being true to that, because you are hopeless and you are naked, and you go look for something. Why is that bad? So not just when we are about to die, or even in some difficulty, you can look for it. And there is that impulse. So.
And we were talking about the situation of someone ill or dying, because that's what Sophie had raised. But it doesn't have to be something negative, though. It doesn't have to be like pain and suffering, although. Generally, we say that's why people come to a practice like this. May not realize it, but it's just that something, they're not satisfied with something, or they're looking for something else. It could be. It can be just, it doesn't have to be a big deal.
Buddha was not satisfied also.
Absolutely.
That's what we read about.
Yeah, and he wasn't.
Wasn't satisfied about something.
And he didn't understand why, how it could happen, how this could be.
And you go and look for an answer.
Exactly. And then what you learn is that. So then, if you do, so you say, "Am I being true to myself?" Whatever. You learn. You gain the confidence that you can actually physically feel when it's right, when you're doing what feels, what is right, and say right, not as opposed to wrong, but you know, it's in your body, you know this is it for you. It can be something very small, like, you know, I know this afternoon this is what I want to do, or something. Or it can be like I felt about this center. I just know it. But I have a long, long experience with this, and learning to trust through the sitting practice and all the koan work or whatever, an experience of knowing when what feels right and what doesn't. It doesn't mean it's always easy, but you learn to trust that. Am I being true to myself? Is this true for me? But it takes, you know, I tell that story of when Roshi and Frank had gone to Chartres, and there was in the cave in the Chartres Cathedral, there's relics from, I don't know what exactly, but, you know, like different Christian relic things, and one of them was supposedly a piece of the shroud from Christ.
What?
Un morceau de tissu de la robe du Christ, and maybe even had blood stains on it or something, I don't know. And they were telling me about this, and I said, I couldn't understand. I said, wait a minute, how is it that this piece of cloth from, you know, Jerusalem, more than 2,000 years ago, could be in the Chartres Cathedral, and could still be
identified as
exactly. How could this be? I just could not believe this, and they said, oh well, you know, it's not really that. No, it's not really that, and I couldn't understand. I was not raised Catholic, you know. And I so how can they present that as being that when everybody knows it's not what it is, you know? And people believe that it's that. Now, of course, I could have gone on to the whole thing of, you know, people believe that Christ was risen from the dead, you know, physically, and walked on the earth again. Anyway, I didn't go there. I was just, couldn't figure this out. And it threw me into a crisis of, well, what is reality? If that's, wait a minute, you know, what is the truth? If that's not truly what it is, and they're saying it is, well, what is true? You know? So this was happening in my head in French, la vérité. And so for weeks I was just, you know, this was my koan driving me crazy. What is la vérité? And one afternoon, Anna and I were in Etretat, on top of the cliffs in Etretat. It was beautiful, amazing things. We'd spent the afternoon just sitting up there on top of the cliffs, and we were walking down then as the sun was setting or whatever, and I was going on and on about this again. I don't remember what he said. He said something about it. He was putting up with my whole questioning thing for weeks, you know. And he said something to me, and I said, so, and I stopped on the path, and I said, so, wait, what you're saying, je suis la vérité? La vérité, c'est moi? And he was like, well, yes. This was a big moment for me. Wow. And it didn't make any sense intellectually. See, I had been looking, of course, as we do with koans, I'd been looking for some explanation, something that made sense in my head. It made absolutely no sense in my head, but in my body, physically, I knew. I said, ah, je suis la vérité. I get it. Which is exactly what Christ said. I wasn't thinking that at the time, but whatever. And Christ, of course, as we know, what they did to him for saying that. You know? Fortunately, I didn't go walking around telling someone, just be the way you think. I mean, he said a lot of things like that. I'm the way, I'm the truth and life, or something.
Truth and the life, or the life.
The life, yeah, something like that.
La voix.
He did say I'm the way, that was one of the things. Maybe I'm the truth and the way, or something. Yeah. And of course, this was impossible to say. So in the same way that when we are suddenly confronted with a crisis of some kind, we suddenly are looking and find something, the equivalent is true with a koan, with a questioning like that, because it throws into doubt everything you know, or think you know. I guess I had a really fixed concept of what is true. Of course, being a journalist, that was part of my work, was to find out the true thing, what was happening, and find the facts, and, you know, this is what, you know, Donald Trump says this, but actually the truth is this, you know, and find out that, whatever. So for me, there was an absolute truth. There was a concrete truth in every situation. So they're sitting here and they're saying, this piece of cloth was Christ, belonged to Christ, when in fact it's not. But they're saying it is, and everyone believes that it is, and I couldn't figure that out. I still don't really understand that, but that's another question. That's another issue. Because I think most people who go there and look at it don't think about it as being true or not. It's an article of faith. It's not a question of truth or not truth. But again, like we were saying yesterday or Friday, the only way to know something like that is to experience it yourself and feel, really, it's in your bones when you know it or not. And like I said, it can be, yes, I know this is what I want for dessert. I want the crème brûlée, not the mousse au chocolat. You know, it's like, it can be something like that.
And is there a difference to intuition, or all that you say reminds me a lot of what I read about intuition or heard about intuition?
Well, and this came up yesterday too when I was talking about, I forget, but I remember saying that, talking about prajna, which is, they often say it's in intuitive wisdom, prajna, or prajna. And it is, it's something like that, but it's more than that, I would say. It has that same kind of feeling that is not, you can't explain it with your head, you just know it.
But maybe it's not as personal as.
Right, maybe that's it. That's a good point, yeah. Maybe it's not personal in that same way. Yeah. Because everyone has the possibility of developing this. Of course, everyone could develop their intuition, as we say. But this awareness, this prajna, as we say, is everyone, as Roshi said this morning too, everybody has it. It's there from birth. That's why the Dalai Lama said, even Mao Zedong has it. Even Mao. And this is what, regardless of Zen or Christianity or Islam or whatever, any spiritual practice, whatever, what is missing a lot in our world today is this aspect. You can call it intuitive, you can call it spiritual, you can call it art, lot of different things you can call it. But our culture today really, really has turned away from that and doesn't... there's no mystery, you know, in our world today. Someone was telling me that. Someone said that was one of the problems today with for young people. It's that there's no possibility of not knowing something, because there's you can always find the answer in the palm of your hand, you know. And they are, even their schooling is presented in such a way where it's not really about studying, researching, exploring. It's more about knowing the answer. It's not so much about opening up and pursuing a field and exploring different aspects of it. It's more about finding an answer. And this is, you know, this is a sorry state of our world. And that's why a practice like this is so radical. It's because it's going in the opposite direction. It's not saying we refuse the, you know, the wisdom of modern science and computers and whatever. But it's saying, we are saying by doing this, that we are looking at this other aspect of life which makes our life complete. I think this is why people turn, you know, this is probably why people turn to a practice like this at the end of their life, because it makes, there's a completion in it. It opens to another aspect of life that has not been encountered. And when we're faced with, you know, death is probably the greatest mystery that is left for us, you know. When we're faced with this incredible, terrifying mystery, well, what do you do? You know, what, no, nothing you know to this point can help you answer that. What can help you with that mystery of death?
It makes me think of my 3-year-old. Last night he said, "I don't know how I'll be in bed when I." And the thoughts for him. At one point he said, "Are we all dying?" Or something like that. Mm-hmm. "Am I dying too?" And so I said, "Yes, we're all dying." And then, but I said, "But I hope it will be in a long time." And then I heard him for another hour or so. He got up in his bed and went to the stairs and then hiding when I came up. And then when I said, "You don't have to run away, what's going on?" And then he came and just said, "I won't be sad if I die." You know, it was really something.
Je vais être triste quand je vais être mort.
And had there been some issue of death during the day, or someone had talked about it, or?
No, I don't think so. And I don't remember how that topic arrived. I don't know exactly how children perceive death. And
no.
I read something about that until 7 or so. It's something.
Mm.
But they don't really get it.
Mm.
What that
even after?
Yeah, even after.
Never. I mean, but yeah. Well, it's a children's brain, which is.
Mais quel âge est-ce qu'il y a? 3, bientôt 4.
Yeah. Well, but I think it sounds like he was experiencing it of like being separated, being alone, being far from you.
Yeah,
and
I mean, that's the sense they might have of it.
Yeah.
That when people die, that they are not no longer there.
Right. He doesn't know where they are, but they're not here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're not with mommy.
Yeah.
Peut-être que pour nous aussi, enfin, je parle pour moi en fait, la question de la mort, c'est... À un moment, j'avais vraiment une question... Enfin, c'était pas une question, c'était quelque chose de très vivant en moi. C'était, c'était plus une idée, une perception que si je mourais maintenant, j'aurais pas vécu ma vie. Et je me disais, mais qu'est-ce que j'ai pas fait, que j'aurais voulu faire, et si je devais mourir, de toute façon, je continuerais à faire ce que je fais. Donc pourquoi ce sentiment très fort? Et je crois maintenant que c'était juste une question de shift intérieur, d'être entière avec ce que je fais, et pas dans l'idée du manque en fait. Et pour moi, ça, ce moment-là, ça a vraiment été je crois que ça a changé les choses finalement, tout.
It does, it changes everything, I think.
Je crois.
Yeah.
Enfin, pour moi, oui.
Yeah. And that's like the equivalent of saying no regrets, because that if the moment is complete, if you did, you know, whatever. What did you say? Tu as fait.
Je me demandais si j'avais l'impression, si je mourais maintenant, j'aurais l'impression de ne pas avoir vécu ma vie, de ne pas avoir fait ce que j'aurais dû faire. Mm-hmm. Et si je me demandais, mais qu'est-ce que j'aurais dû faire? Il y avait tout ce que j'avais fait qui était bien. Enfin, je veux dire, voilà, il n'y a rien à changer, même si j'ai encore qu'un an à vivre. Je continue la même chose, il n'y a rien à changer, alors qu'est-ce qui se passe, quoi?
And that's why we say appreciate your life. Because appreciate this very moment. Because this is the only moment there is, in fact. This is it. Again, that's the good news and the bad news. This is it. And if we live fully this moment, then we're in peace. Like you say, it's peaceful. You know? Of course, we don't know because we're not. None of us are in the situation where we're like on our deathbed. But I know, experiencing that myself when my father was dying, and after he died, I felt very much that same thing. It was complete. You know, I was fulfilled in what I had lived with him. Of course, I was sad that he died and he was gone, and it was a long process of grieving, whatever, but it was complete. There was nothing missing. You know, like instead of focusing on the lack, like you said, the monk. Yeah.
Et ça, j'avais pas, pendant des années et des années et des années, pourtant à entendre. Ah, ok, j'entendais être là, appreciate your life, le bouquin de Maizumi, enfin je veux dire, j'entendais ça, et je demandais qu'à m'en convaincre, mais j'étais tellement dans le manque que, enfin je le voyais pas comme pendant finalement, comme...
I'm reading a book right now which is called Tout est là, juste là. I think she's a psychologist or something, and is practicing the meditation de pleine conscience, mindfulness, based stress reduction, same from John Kabat-Zinn. And it's especially adapted to or addressing parent issues and how we can teach that our children mindfulness. And a lot of what you said reminded me of what she writes, that if we don't, that sitting and observing your breath or whatever you do when you meditate is cultivating this sense of of wonder or of appreciating the moment and not being in this hurry all the time and activism. And that might maybe take the après la suite de might follow, because I think the what religion did sometimes is address at least some points of what we talk about of compassion, and it's disappearing more and more, I find. And, you know, I still grew up with some religious education, but I don't give that to my children because I'm not in that anymore. And so if there is no, we don't talk about stories or what Christ did or something like that, because you might really think that it's all that you see in the world today, mm-hmm. all that.
It's just this.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Although, you know, in a sense, it's fortunate that the Pope, who is the Pope today, is who he is, because he you know, there's a whole thing with the Vatican and everything, but he at least is, he made a big sign by choosing the name Paul Francis, and has focused a lot on compassion and instead of the usual stuff that the Popes past have focused on, so. Doctrine, you know.
Yeah.
But it's true, huh? Our world is not a. And I often think of the quote that André Malraux, the French intellectual, and I don't know what in context he said it, but he said something like, "The 21st century will be spiritual, or it won't be at all." And he said this in, like, you know, 1965 or something. I don't know at what point. I don't know when Malraux died. Does anyone know? You know, it could have been 1970 when he said it. But and I often think of that. That, you know, if we keep going the direction we're going, well, we probably will end up having to be in a crisis and have to do something, you know, as a culture, as a society. It will all fall apart as we know it, you know.
There is a book by David Lloyd, he's an American Buddhist teacher. And his and the title of the book is "The World Is Made of Stories," and he's saying in his book that he's quoting a poem by I don't remember who that says the world is not made of atoms; it's made of stories, because stories and stories like religions or the stories that are produced by science or any kind of stories, they shape the world in which we live. And like, for example, if he says at some point in his book that believing in a religion where there is one God that is the absolute authority justifies social structure based on authority also, and things like that. And I really, really like this book. I've read it a few times, and every time it makes me dive into a lot of thinking about what stories am I living, and also really when I read his book, I wish I could know what life is beyond stories. Is there something? Is there a reality if you take all these stories off? And And I'm also worrying about in Buddhism, are we in the end just making another story? Like, I know that it's a practice that is based on experience, but I've also I've studied cognitive science and I've been trained during my studies to not trust my experience, I think, in order to design experiments that would reveal how a human being, a human mind works, and not fall into the trap of how can I say that? It's really difficult to experiment on a human being because everything you say or the way you present a topic, or even the order in which you ask the question, may modify the question, may modify the answers. And it's easy. I think as human beings, we're really good at believing what we want to believe. Like if you are asked to touch a surface, and you're being told that the surface is smooth. If after that you're being asked, is the surface smooth or not, you may answer, yes, it is smooth, I can feel it. So I was trained at thinking about the human experience and human mind in a way that I would not trust the experience, but try and find out about it only in terms of facts. And if I get back to the idea of stories, I know that this practice is based on experience, but I'm wondering how much is that experience just a creation of everything I've read and heard? I think it's not entirely impossible that I have experience, but they actually experience things, but that what I've experienced is a construction rather than a direct experience of reality, rather than an experience of something that is beyond thoughts and stories and this mental construction.
Yeah, that's exactly why I tell people not to read books about this practice. Exactly for that reason. Because it is hard to you can be tricked, or you can be looking for a specific, like you say, you know, if people say, if everyone is saying this is smooth, and this, so then you're going to be looking for it to feel smooth or something. You know.
Conditioned.
Well, okay, you can be conditioned that way as well. What?
We are.
If people say this is what it is,
we are conditioned. Everything that
it's like we were saying yesterday, it's everything has an effect on us, right? At the same time, I can testify that it is possible to experience something that is not what I read. You know, I'm just using the same that example, and we all can. You know, I mean. We tell
you, know, it's not a creation of your mind.
Well, okay, so you drink a glass of water, or you drink a cup of tea, or something. You have an experience of that that is doesn't, you know, it's not like something that has been, someone has told you what it should taste like, or you've read that this is what water is, what it's like to drink a glass of water. You have an experience of it, whatever it is, and then you may. The stories, as we say, and he's really good, David Loy. I've read bits of that book. The stories are what we come after. So we have an experience, and then we tell a story about it. It's part of our way of interacting as human beings, is to tell stories about what it is, you know, whatever is happening. And when he's talking about stories, it doesn't mean that they're false or that they're fantasy or that they're made up, but it's just that that's how we communicate, that that's how we share our experiences or something. There's nothing wrong with that. However, it's difficult if we believe that the point is the story, to then come back to our experience of what anything is, what is happening at this very moment. So we sit, this is part of the practice of sitting here, is to not become involved with the story. The stories come up, whatever it is arises. Story, that's why I say, you know, try this translation meditation. So you're given a story. You have a whole story about what's in front of you. And you're asked, and say, translate it into another language. Already that's taking you a step from what you're attached to, of how you tell the story usually. But then I say, translate it into a language that you don't know. So choose a language, Russian or Turkish or, you know, I don't know, some language that you don't know, Eskimo, something. And then translate it into that language. In order to translate, we all know, because we all speak several languages here. In order to translate, you have to get out of your mind what the thing is in whatever language you're based. So I have to get out of my mind that this is napkin in English. In order to allow something else to arise, I have to let go of my initial thing, right? So otherwise, I would never be able to say serviette. If I'm stuck with on the napkin, I will never say serviette. I will never open to something else if I'm stuck on napkin. Now, if it's a language that you don't know, and I mean, if you really take it, décortique the whole process of translating, it's like you're opening a space around the word, the concept, the object, whatever it is. You open the space around it. You remove the word that you know in your whatever language, your original language, and you allow the word to come up that you're translating into. So I open the space around it. I let napkin go, and then serviette can come. But if you're doing this with a language that you don't know, and this whole thing of experiencing things as they are is about experiencing them in a language you don't know, which is not even a language. It's beyond language, things as they are. It's before language, let's say. It's before. So the question of what is there when there's not the story, things as they are. But then we immediately put stories onto them. So if you don't speak the language you're trying to translate into, you're left with just this. But in the direct experience of what it is, without a word on it, without the concept, without the story. As soon as serviette is a story that we're putting on this as it is. Or, you know, white serviette, small paper serviette, or, you know, whatever. And then our opinions of, oh, this is wasteful, we shouldn't have paper because then it's recycling and, you know, the ecology and everything. And then, well, okay, so maybe we should buy some serviette on tissue. Well, we don't have any money for that. Well, maybe my mother has some she could give me, or maybe we can ask somebody to make some. What color should we have? Maybe we should get white. Well, might be nice to have some different colored ones. Maybe we could ask Christine to make them because she can sew. Or maybe Eddie, she could do some really nice ones and we could get her to put the logo. How did she put that logo on? You know? And pretty soon, you have this story that has nothing to do with what is, you know? And there's nothing wrong with that story. It's not that it's bad, it's just missing. It's going beyond what it is, right? The story too is what it is. It's like we were saying yesterday, everything is prajna. So the story too is what is. But we tend to think that the thing, you know, the piece of cloth that's in Chartres, we go with the story, you know, and then what it becomes and all of this stuff. That too is the story, but we become caught up and think that the story is what is the absolute reality. And it is, but it's not just that.
Et à ce point, finalement, l'enseignement que tu peux donner, qu'on peut entendre, c'est très, enfin pour moi, je ressens que ça peut être, et ça a été très tricky, parce que c'était une histoire que j'entendais. C'était une belle histoire à laquelle qui me parlait
là,
très
juste
profondément.
Maintenant
non, de façon générale.
Ah, oui.
Et avant tout l'enseignement que j'ai pu entendre de Roshi, je reviens finalement à ce que je disais tout à l'heure. Et ben c'était de belles histoires, pas seulement des belles histoires, mais qui me parlaient profondément. Et donc je m'y attachais. Et en m'y attachant. Si je m'y attachais, c'est parce que je ne les vivais pas, je ne les avais pas, et le fait même de m'y attacher, ça m'éloignait d'une autre langue, pour reprendre des termes. Mm. Ça m'éloignait d'une autre réalité. Et finalement, bon, moi, c'est par l'analyse qu'il y a une autre langue qui a émergé, finalement. Mm.
Mais l'analyse is also a story.
Ok. Mais ça m'a permis
de décoller de l'autre.
Voilà.
Oui,
voilà. Oui. Et c'est comme si finalement, dans tout ce que tu dis, il faut deux langues ou deux histoires ou un autre truc qui permette de sortir de l'histoire initiale. Et pourtant, il la faut bien, l'histoire initiale.
It's the only way to communicate, yeah.
Oui, ben, je veux dire, si je n'avais pas entendu Rocher la première fois et les fois suivantes, jamais j'aurais senti cet appel vers la pratique. Mm-hmm. Donc, il me fallait l'entendre et en même temps, il ne fallait pas que je reste collée à ça.
Mm-hmm.
Donc, c'est vachement... Enfin, pour moi, ça a été très ambivalent. Enfin, pas ambivalent. Tricky.
Mm-hmm. Because we grab onto it, ouais. Absolutely. Well, and this is why the Buddha initially said he wasn't going to say anything. How could he? You can't say it, and he understood that you just have to experience it yourself. And he, you know, kind of like the situation. Well, how he didn't want to influence anyone, or you can't tell them what it is, right? You can only he thought you couldn't even say anything, so he just was not going to say anything. What?
Et pourtant, faut le dire.
And then he realized that it was because someone asked him, and so he answered that. It wasn't that he went out and said, you know, this is what I'm going to tell you all about this. But someone asked him and said, what happened? They said, what happened to you? You look different. Where have you been all these, however long he was gone? Because he went to see his old comrades who were these ascetics in the forest, right? Who he had seen that practice for him had been not right. And he had a lot of compassion for them. So he went to see them because he cared about them and he was feeling compassionate. And when he went there, they said to him, he didn't go there to tell them anything, but when he did, they said to him, what happened to you? Where have you been? They could see something different about him. And he told them where he had been and what had happened. And that's how it started. And then he realized that someone else asked, and someone else asked, and someone else asked, and he talked. And that's how it always happens, you know? But he also kept telling people, but you have to experience it yourself. Don't believe what I say. You know, don't. And that I love that quote, you know, that is very inspiring for me, which is, don't seek to walk in the footsteps of the wise. Seek what they sought. So, you know, don't try to do exactly what they're doing and follow their story and be exactly like them. Look for what they were looking for, because that's the same. That's what you will find is what they found then, if you seek what they sought. Ne cherchez pas à marcher dans les pas des sages. Cherche ce que eux ils ont cherché.
that's what you also do in a way, because you also tell us that I saw this, I experienced this, but you don't just say this, you know, you make available different ways to for us to. You don't just get stuck. You don't want us to just get stuck here and listening to what you are saying. Oh, I know this because, and that's it. You know, you just have to believe it.
Mm.
That's not what you do.
Well, and sometimes I have the same feeling as the Buddha, and I feel like, well, there's nothing to say. I'm just not going to say anything. But I know that doesn't help anyone. You know, that's not what it is either. But I have had moments when, you know, there was a moment even when I was just going to quit the whole thing and not do it, you know. And who knows, maybe that will happen again, I don't know. But for the moment, that's not what it is. For the moment, it's not so much that I'm going to talk and say things, but it's I'm making available a space where we can practice and make this practice available to other people. But ultimately, it's not, I can't do it for them, you know? I can't do it for you. And there would be absolutely no interest in me doing it for you.
But we have to believe at some point.
Believe what?
Right?
Well,
I think
what happens is, you know,
then it's difficult.
Because I think, you know, there's this really good book by Stephen Batchelor, Buddhism Beyond Beliefs. Because I'm not sure it's so much about believe. You know, it's like people believe that's the piece of
trust.
Fabric from the. Yeah, but it's something you're trusting your own sense, you're trusting what you feel. And being, you know, Roshi used the word today, inspired, you know, that she felt that it was inspiring what Myoji was doing by renewing her vows. And there's something, we can be inspired by a story. Whether it's, this whole thing of, you know, Buddhism, no. The thing of Zen, you know, Bodhidharma. Who even knows if Bodhidharma existed? Well, it doesn't even matter if he existed. You know, it doesn't matter exactly. It's not something like, you know, in the Christian faith or in Islam or maybe even Judaism, I don't know. You know, there's a place and there was someone who was there and this happened, and if you don't believe it, then you're tu es non croyant.
Yeah. Well, that's how we practice it here.
It's not about quiet here.
But Buddhism in certain countries in the East is.
Oh, it could be, yes, absolutely.
It is faith.
Yeah, it is. It becomes a doctrine and a dogma.
And that's what people know about it mainly.
Some people. That's
considered a religion.
When I talked about on the radio, with the guy on the radio, Fabrice Midal, who said, you know, this whole thing that you're showing in your reportage. With the nice music and the bells and the llamas, and it's the religion, and that's not what it's about. So we can say some people believe that. There are also Christians who are not attached to the doctrines and the dogma and all of that either, you know. Or
so it's hard to explain, because it becomes something else, or
but
belief.
The original origin, though, of Buddhism is different than the other religions. What?
Monotheism.
Yeah. What is that in English? I forget. Whatever. You know, in that there is no God. We're not talking about a God. There's not a belief in something other than this, you know. There's nothing other than this. So it's not asking you to believe something else apart from this. And it's not even saying believe what I'm saying, that there's nothing other than this. It's saying look, this is my experience. You know, the Buddha, he looked really hard and tried to find what could possibly be other than this, and he couldn't find it. And he found
and
this.
And why isn't that just a construct of the mind? Another one.
If it can be, if you experience it as a construct of your mind. What I'm telling you is, my experience is that it's not a construct of the mind.
So I have to trust you.
You don't. I'm saying try it for yourself. You don't have to trust me at all.
Mais après, à partir de l'expérience dont je parlais à Jean, à partir de l'expérience que j'ai pu me faire et de ce que j'ai pu entendre, c'est comme si je m'étais construit une histoire qui ressemblait beaucoup à celle que j'entendais, la compassion, aller vers l'autre. Mm-hmm. Je me suis créé cette histoire, et c'est au-delà de toute croyance. C'est une histoire à laquelle, pour moi-même, je voulais totalement adhérer parce que je voulais être différente de ce que j'étais. Je voulais être meilleure, je voulais être plus ci, plus ça, moins ça, moins... Et c'est ce que j'entends par histoire et au-delà de croyances, le Bouddha, son arbre.
But the, again, you know, the key, there are key words in there of je, I, voulu, wanted, where what I'm talking about is not even something about I or wanting or not wanting.
Et c'est pour ça que...
There's an interesting story that... Stephen Batchelor tells too, because he has done it all. You know, he was a monk in India, he was a monk in Korea, he was a Tibetan, you know, Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, Korean Zen practitioner. He's done a lot of vipassana, mindfulness stuff, whatever, anyway. And he's a great intellectual. So he tells a story about when he was in, I think, India. So he was, or Nepal, maybe. So he was with, and it's one of these things where there's the great Tibetan teacher, the Lama, you know, great Rinpoche comes and all this stuff and all the ceremonies. I forget all the details. But everyone, suddenly there was this, you know, story of when the teacher emerged or something, a rainbow appeared, right? And everyone was talking about it, how they had seen this rainbow. And he found himself saying there was a rainbow when he hadn't actually seen it. And this really bothered him that he was doing that. And it took him a long time, you know, then he got disillusioned with that whole practice and went and did something else. And that's kind of what you're saying. He wanted to see the rainbow. He wanted it to be something miraculous. It wasn't his experience. He, to this day, doesn't know if there was a rainbow there or not. He said he saw it because he wanted it to be that way. But in fact, he really doesn't know. And he thinks probably everybody else was saying it because they wanted it to be that too. They want the, you know, they want the Rinpoches to be, have supernatural powers and be these, you know, incredible beings who are reincarnated a million times and, you know, can do anything and all this stuff. When in fact, that's not what it's about. But that's what we want. We want something other than this. So we want it to be extraordinary, we want it to be beautiful, we want it to be, you know.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, that's what he's saying in his situation.
Because I wouldn't be sitting here.
No, he probably wouldn't. Yeah.
It's something.
But that's what he was saying, and that's what I hear in what Brigitte's saying.
S'il y avait cette dimension spectaculaire, je ne croirais pas.
Et en même temps, ça, toutes ces histoires, ça peut prendre, parce que finalement, on sent que ça correspond à quelque chose en nous. Enfin, ces histoires, je ne parle pas de Rinpoche, de machin extraordinaire, mais juste de vouloir être meilleur, on entend beaucoup parler.
It's the same élan, it's the same.
Voilà. Mais c'est parce qu'en fait, on le porte en nous, et c'est pour ça que ça nous parle autant.
On porte quoi? Le désir de...
Même le fait qu'on le soit déjà. Même le fait qu'on le soit déjà, on le porte.
Yeah, we are that already.
Et c'est pour ça que ça nous parle. Mm-hmm. Mais Et en même temps, c'est on se sent à des lieux de ça.
Mm-hmm. Because we don't see who we truly are.
Oui.
We don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it doesn't mean that you are looking for that too. I'm just saying that that's when mm-hmm. she said that, that was what it comes from, that impulse of, you know, wanting, you know, something else. And that's very dangerous when that kind of thing happens, you know. When we don't trust ourselves, or we, you know. But it's very, very profound and human, because if we can't, if there's nothing other than this, that can be incredibly frightening. You know, if there's no person, authority, who's better than me, who knows. You know, it's the kind of situation, you know, people say when their second parent dies. It's frightening because, well, the next in line is me, you know. Or if you don't, if you've, you know, given up on the various authorities in your life, and you're assuming you have become your own authority, your own master, well, that's frightening because there's nobody you can rely on anymore. Right? And we would like to have always someone else. Someone knows more, someone knows better, something else other than this. But
it's like, we actually have a socially an absolute authority. It's not God anymore, but it's like that framework in which fits science, and like if things don't fit into this framework, then you can't believe it. It's not fine. You should there's a problem with you if you get if you related to it or give any consideration to it. It's like And the problem, maybe one problem that we're facing when we're practicing this, is that by definition, maybe we can't justify it within this framework because it doesn't fit in it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so
justify it in the scientific framework.
Yeah, or scientific or like. Logical framework or like mm-hmm. the framework that requires rigorous thinking, and I think in fact it's even a problem to myself, because there is me that is practicing this and that wants to do it. And there is me that was raised and trained into that framework, and those kind of fight each other, I guess.
Mm-hmm. When you say rigorous thinking, it's true. What a practice like this involves is rigorous being. It's rigorous. Mm-hmm. There's rigor, but it's not thinking. It's being. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely why it doesn't. It can be frightening that it doesn't fit in the framework you're talking about, you know, of rigorous thinking. It can't, you know. It's like, you know, it's like asking the wrong question. It doesn't fit. It doesn't apply. Even the same systems, the same question, the same approach. It doesn't apply. It's like comparing apples and oranges, you know. So it doesn't apply. And even our resistance to it, you know, we can say we can challenge it with the rigorous thought, or we can even, you know, what's become very popular now is, like what I was saying the other day, neuroscience and Buddhism. It's become very popular to use neuroscience as proof that so there really is something happening when you practice meditation. Your brain is really being affected, and we can show it. Look, here's the images, and here's the electro, what do you call them? And when you do this kind of meditation, this part of your brain is affected, and when you do this kind of meditation, this part of your brain is. It's like giving empirical proof to what is already the experience, because it's as if that's not enough, the experience that our culture is asking for empirical proof. When in fact, there is proof. There is proof in the life of the person, and in then their the way that they live their life, and the way that your life is transformed by this, whether or not the electrocardiogram says it is or not. You know, it's not a cardiogram. What is it? Electro? What do you call that?
Brain waves.
EEG.
EEG, yes, EEG. But, yeah.
Electroencephalogram.
No? Yeah, maybe that's it.
Rigorous being, is that?
Rigorous being. He's talking about being trained as a scientist in rigorous thinking.
Mm. To provide a rigorous being?
Well, c'est this is rigorous being, yeah.
C'est être de façon rigoureuse.
Oui.
Yeah.
J'ai entendu associer les deux mots.
Well, I have talked a lot about rigor.
Certainement, mais pas forcément.
And I've talked a lot about being.
J'entends particulièrement.
Going back a bit to the question of the talking about belief and faith,
mm-hmm.
I was rather thinking about engagement, because we talked yesterday about engagement and really doing it, really engaging in the practice, I mean. So instead, because of this practice, that's where it points to. It's towards engagement, not towards believing or towards faith in what you say or whatever, but it allows us, that's where it invites us to, because if you think, for instance, in a session, how many hours, what do we do the most? Is sitting on the zafu.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else comes second. We don't
mm-hmm.
do nothing as much as sitting. I was also thinking that with the practice of, for instance, with the koans or maybe in other situations, when you are, because we talked about this yesterday also, you have the opportunity to experience glimpses, those very small glimpses that you say then that you, it's important that you feed them, because the more you experience them, the more familiar you become with it, or something like that. So, it all comes back to the experiencing thing. You know, that's what the practice invites us to do, to experience. Not believing, it's not asking us to believe, or to have faith. It's just, so it's always just inviting us to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else. At least that's how I am.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And also reminded me of something you sometimes you say, that you might not come in the sessions, I mean, you might not know why you come, but you come, well, the persons who do it, of course, but you come, and you come again, and you come again. Nobody's asking you to come, and
mm-hmm.
nobody's telling you to come. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You can come, you cannot come. And there are people who come and come again, and there are people who don't, and that's
mm-hmm.
that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know why I come.
Mm.
In a way, I don't. I just know that I do.
Mm.
I want to
nothing
come.
Better to do.
Well, I could find, I'm sure I could do homework, you know, I had tons of work, I could be doing all sorts of practical things, you know, it's but
I don't have anything better to do, actually.
No, I mean, I could find out. I certainly need to
I can't
to
think
work,
of anything right? better than this, actually.
Yeah,
but
yeah, no.
But the, let's say, the scientific approach to it, to figure out what the effect is on the brain, proving things, what effect it has on the body, and it's not such a bad thing, no?
No.
It makes it accessible
absolutely.
To...
Absolutely. That's why they do it,
and
yeah.
And dropping all the religious stuff or spiritual things and just get to the... the facts, you know, that basically it helps people reduce chronic pain and stress and make people more compassionate and whatever. I mean, it's maybe the only way that it can get a breakthrough into our society because we function that way. You know, I have, I lived a long time in the scientific.
You also are a scientist. Yeah.
I'm a scientist, so I know a lot of these people who only believe what they can, what you can prove. So you can't, as long as you can prove it, that they won't sit down on a cushion.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I recently read something in like Libé or Le Monde or something, where there was a study of stress reduction. Affecting chronic illness, you know, these various things that they say, you know, that they promote, when they promote mindfulness, they promote these things. And according to the statistics, the study they had done, actually none of the things could actually be proven. Because you can't really prove that, you know. They couldn't show that it had cured people of a terminal illness. Where they couldn't show that it actually reduced their stress. Some people said it had, but others didn't, and they couldn't actually. There was no, you know, concrete evidence of it, according to these surveys that they had done. And I was really surprised because that's how it's presented.
Yeah.
And you hear people's stories of.
I read is that they took the cortisol level at 8 in the morning, at the time when the cortisol has a peak, and that after this 8-week stress mindfulness program, they have significant lower levels of cortisol, stress hormones. So, I think they are true because...
Absolutely,
these the research that has been done.
Yeah.
We have so many ways to
actually stress was the one that they could prove the best. That had the highest statistics of proof.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other things there was absolutely no empirical evidence.
Nobody ever claimed that it can cure chronic illness
But they were testing it all anyway, just to see, you know. They decided, well, let's just test all of these things and see what happens. But and that's true, huh? That it does make it available, and that's also why, you know, we do all kinds of practices to make it. That's why we'll have an open house, you know, to make it available to people, speaking in a language and look at, you know, what we do here is very different from what they do in Montreuil. You know, I mean, we don't wear robes or anything like that. It's less formal, whatever. It's to make it more accessible. At the same time, it's important not to confuse the results with what the practice, what it's really about. That's all I'm saying. I'm not discounting it. And to also not water it down, you know, not lose what the essence of it is. Either by making it less formal, so making it more appealing, or you know, making it fun, or making it more scientific, or whatever it is that appeals to people. It's important to use these skillful means, whatever it takes, but not lose the point.
Of rigor being. Of de la rigueur
de l'être. Being, yeah.
De la rigueur de l'être.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
And it seems also because we're talking about science, how science proves or disproves. It seems to be a concern more and more because there is so much meditation and mindfulness and variations of that kind. There have been some more and more. There are concerns of that things. In many places, things are much concerned with that exactly that the stress reduction and the pursuit of more happiness and general well-being of the individual. I see more and more articles and stuff with that kind of worries because that's important. Definitely, but it kind of feels like there's something else. There's something more.
Yeah, because it still remains then a materialistic practice of trying to obtain some result, of trying to obtain something. And right, that can be a trap. Yeah.
And science is used a lot to justify that.
Well, like I said it Friday or yesterday, that science, there's a limit to what science can understand about, because it's applying analytical, you know, experiments and things, and analytical thought, because it's about thought, it's not about being, and so there's always will be something that will escape scientific understanding of being. There's an aspect of being that will always escape. And even, you know, so I forget, there's some like great huge scientific studies that have breakthroughs that have been accidents, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think even Einstein, wasn't it? It was like a complete accident or something. Yeah. Almost when they gave up, or you know, two things that they did by accident, and you know, these unbelievable things.
As well as the kitchen recipe.
Yeah.
That. Exactly. La sauce bernaise is the only one I remember. It's been an accident.
It was an accident. Exactly.
It has become something.
But that's something that's sort of bothering me right now, is the idea that this is perceived, or I perceive it, or this is what I'm the image I'm sent back from others, that it's a crutch.
What is
the
key?
La pratique.
What do you mean by that?
Just the crutch to live your life. It's like cycle now. Like anything, like any practice. Something that you do because you can't deal with it. It's a crutch.
Maybe I understand that. So you're saying that's how you feel about it?
No, I ask myself, is it a crutch?
Yeah.
Am I using it because I can't deal with something?
And if it was, is that,
I have it.
Is that
well, it's a new, yeah.
And if that is the case, then how do you feel about that?
Yeah.
You know, is that if it is, I'm not saying it is. You question that. So if it is that, then what? What does that mean for you? What is that?
A weakness.
You see it as a weakness. Okay.
A crutch is a weakness.
Well, so that's important to look at.
Yeah.
So, okay. And if so, what is a weakness? What does that say about you then? If you're weak, you don't have to answer this right now. You can look at that though. And
but it's also something that's images, something that you are. That's how it's seen as well, or it can be seen from external people who don't practice it. And it's like, okay, well, you know, she needs something to.
It could be, sure, of course, yeah.
And it's fine. It's just you need to be able to also answer that. So it pushes yourself to look at it.
I mean, if you need to answer that, what I always hear people is say the truth, you know. So if that is what it is, then say yes, that's to who's asking you, then say yes, that's what it is. I mean, I don't know. In any case, if we're seeing it as a crutch, you know, so like this, then it's still something outside. It's not my life. And that I'm not saying that it should be your life, but that's an indication. If we see it as a crutch, then it's separate from me. You know, it's something that is attached to me, or I'm leaning on, or something. Whereas if it's your life, you know, if your practice is your life, and your life is your practice, then it's not something outside of you. And I think people, when you say it, as when you said the word outside, that's what made me think of it. People outside of it look at it in a certain way. Well, of course, because it's not their experience. You know, they're not doing it. Same thing with, yeah, people who, you know, I don't know, people who spend their life doing fencing or something, you know. I don't know anything about what that is for them. I have no idea what l'escrime is for somebody, you know, or...
Yeah, you wouldn't be asked this question the same way. You're just doing a sport.
Well, I don't know.
I'm not longer in contact with him, but it was a friend who did les arts martiaux with the also the
sword. Yeah, yeah.
And the only thing once he told me about was you're completely there.
It's a way, it's a path, exactly.
So it has some, you know,
it's a path.
When you do that, you can only do it if you have no other thought than what you do. Mm. And no other.
Yeah,
you can be distracted and you can be.
So, you know, but it comes back to, so it's not so much what other people think about it, it's what you think about it, you know, and sometimes we project onto other people what we think about it, you know. So, I mean, when I first started, my idea, when somebody told me I should do meditation, I had all these ideas about meditation, and I thought, are you kidding me? Meditation? You know, what? I had, you know, these people, I thought they were like flaky and weird and it was a waste of time and, you know, what?
I thought it would be boring.
No, it just
boring.
Didn't correspond to anything I thought that was interesting in life, you know. And, but I had all my ideas about it. And then when I actually did it, when I had, you know, managed to get rid of my ideas about it, it was nothing like what I had thought, and I understood what other people's views of it were, but it didn't matter to me what they thought about it. Of course, I didn't go around telling everybody I was practicing meditation, because, you know, some people I knew couldn't. I didn't want to go there with them, you know. But otherwise, it really didn't matter to me what other people thought, because I didn't need to project onto them what I was thinking about it, you know, and I had my own experience of it, I trusted my experience of it, you know, so it didn't really matter what other people said. But, as I say, I didn't tell it to some, you know, I didn't walk around my office and tell all my colleagues I was practicing meditation. Even just last week, someone came, someone who my son was babysitting for the night we had the opening here. So he babysits for one of my colleagues. And so William had told him that night when he finished the babysitting that he was coming here. And had told him what it was, this colleague. So last week, this colleague walks up, and a group of us were talking, this colleague walks up and he said, Amy, congratulations, that's great, everything, and people were kind of looking at me. And he said, so, you know, how's the center and everything? And people were like, what center? So I said, yeah, I opened a Zen center last week. You didn't tell us? So that's what you're going to do now after we're all fired in, you know, really? And I said, yeah, yeah. It's, oh, wow. And they had no idea. They had no idea. And it was a very positive reaction. I probably could have told these people years ago. But I didn't. I didn't feel the need to. And it didn't matter, you know.
But the thing with the center is that it pushes us to say it more or talk about it more.
You mean as an individual talking in your entourage or something?
Yeah, or also by taking action for you have to say it.
That's true. You don't have to, let's say,
well,
because
say, well, I'm part of this group and renting out this place, so you have to say it somehow.
If you want to, really trying to help people stay with what is their comfort zone, you know, what they're comfortable doing and not doing. And if that's uncomfortable to then be confronted with people's reactions, then it's okay not to do it. It's also okay to be confronted, you know, it's interesting to see, okay, so what is it for me? And I always say, just stay with your heart. What is it really for you? And if you don't know, say you don't know. You know?
Can you say two more sentences about how your colleagues are dealing with the ending of their career as a journalist, or how was the atmosphere?
In lots of different ways. Everyone is doing it in their different ways, you know.
And did you have a discussion or something official for you to mark the ending or something?
It's not over yet. So we will have something, yeah.
Okay.
We'll have some sort of party or something, you know. But, you know, like, for example, this, when suddenly this colleague says, oh, so congratulations, so everyone's saying, oh, really? There was one woman who knew about it already, because she used to do yoga at the Red Earth Center. So she knew that I was doing this. So she was interested. She was like, oh, really? Wow. And then, so, of course, then the jokes are, wow, we all should go there. You know, we all could use that. And of course, no one will come, but, you know. Or one of my colleagues reinvent himself as a psychotherapist. And so then the jokes were all, oh, we could all use a shrink, you can have a whole newsroom of clients, you know. Joking, because they don't really understand what it is, but... I do know the whole... one of my initial difficulties myself when I... started doing this practice was, what do I say? You know, what do I say to my colleagues? Where am I going? Or, you know, what do I say to my friends? And what do I say? I understand totally the question. But I think that it was such a powerful thing that I trusted that what I was doing was what was right for me, and then I learned to... There were situations when I didn't have to say anything. There were situations when normally I would have thought, because it's, you know, interactions with people, I have to tell them what I'm doing this weekend, and I have to, you know, explain or whatever. I didn't. I learned that I didn't have to, and that if I didn't know, then I just didn't say. You know, I would say, I don't know. With my family, you know, or things like that.
Tu n'as pas parlé de ta pratique dans ton travail et pas non plus dans ta famille, c'est ça?
In my family, I didn't say I didn't talk about it, but in my family, not so much, you know. I mean, I did. If they asked questions, I would tell them, and at some points they did. But it was a big step for me at one point when I offered my mother a book about, you know, it was like, I think it was a Thich Nhat Hanh book, you know, something like very accessible, you know. And I don't even remember why I did that, but it's for her birthday or something. And that was a big thing. And she was very touched by it. She was very touched because I said, you know, this is because I would like to share with you what I'm doing. And she was very moved. She cried, in fact, just for a few seconds. But my mother doesn't cry. Like, this was like for a few seconds. She cried and then she stopped immediately. But she was very touched. I wasn't asking her to understand or agree or anything. I said to her, I just want to share with you what I'm doing. And that was a big difference. And often, I think, and I see more and more that that's what's important. It's that instead of trying to make the other person believe what you're talking about or agree that it's the way to go or something, it's just saying, I just want to share it with you, you know, and you don't have to like it or dislike it, or I'm not asking you to like it, you know.
Not even hoping that the person will understand.
Right. I had no hope that my mother would understand. Believe me. I had no hope. But I think she did. You know, I think she... you know, in a sense, I talk about my mother as being kind of not so great, but, you know, I think on a certain level my mother is totally accepting and trusts me that if I'm doing what I'm doing, it must be that it's right for me. And I think but she appreciated just the gesture that I was saying, I want to share with you what I'm doing.
And what about when you see that, I think you see that, I think about my mother also, she doesn't quite get it, and I know.
Join the club.
Yeah. Because I don't know what I get, what I'm getting. But anyway, you know, because she actually called me. And I don't know if it was Friday. Or I was walking. So yes, Friday afternoon. I went by the river. She called me. So are you happy? Is everything working okay for you? So you're doing that. You know, she kind of now and again she will. So I guess you're doing that. It makes you feel good. You know, happy. Yeah. That's you know. But, what? When she says things like that, you know, why should I? I don't have to explain her much.
And maybe it's enough for her just to say.
Yeah, because that's what she's not worried, but that's what comes to her. If I'm good, if I'm happy, yeah, I'm good. I'm happy. Yeah.
Gottfried and Frank, some of you know Frank and Gottfried, right? The brothers, mm-hmm. Duval. And once their mother came to a retreat in Vimoutier, and so we had a summer retreat, and she stayed for 2 weeks, actually. And she did everything. She sat in a chair, and she came to all the talks, and did all the meditation, and the whole thing, you know. Were you there when she came? No. Yeah. And at the time, Gottfried was struggling with Mu. You know, he's working on Mu and he's like going crazy with it. And so there would be a week of sitting, and then Saturday afternoon and Sunday were off days, and Sunday night we would start again between weeks. And so like Sunday they went to the beach or something, you know, and they were hanging around all day and having dinner and lunch, and Gottfried was like, you know, cogite with Mu or whatever. And his mother said, well, you know, Gottfried, I don't know why you're having so much trouble with it. It's so obvious what Mu is. and you know, she talks about it all the time in her talks, and it's in this book right here, because they'd given their mother a book to read. But she said, it's right here what Mu is.
Okay.
But that was quite something that she actually came to the retreats, you know, and she, I think she wanted to see what her sons were doing, you know, like what, one of them had left his job and moved to Paris, you know, it's kind of like, what?
My mom was supposed to come this summer for the Jukai.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, then she forgot.
That's interesting. We call that in an app Freudian act monkey.
Yeah. Actually, that was this uncomfortable moment a few months ago. I think the band, I had played with the band and the kids, and we were all out to dinner. My ex-wife, my mother, my aunts, two of my aunts were there. Then my mother started talking about how in the summer, you know, I was going to do, my aunts don't have a clue about none of this. And it was kind of uncomfortable because my mother starts talking, you know, in the summer I'm going up there in the north, Portugal, you know, because he's doing like, I don't know exactly what she's doing. Vows, she starts talking about the vows. And that was kind of, you know, they don't get it, you know, what the hell she's talking about. Yeah, and then, well, then she forgot. And then I was showing her the pictures a few days ago. I was talking about, she was talking about the summer probably. Oh, so when are you taking the vows? You know, well, I did August 6th. What? Yeah, I told you about it, you know. Yeah. For my mother, I would have to, you know, I would have to buy her the train ticket and take
sure.
care of.
And maybe you didn't want to do this.
No, I could have, but I had a thousand things, you know, to think about. Taking two kids for 3 weeks outside of home for 3 weeks.
Mm.
I had, you know, if she really wanted to. I would have. It would have been nice to have her there. Even my ex-wife, that would have been nice. I was not expecting it because it's such a long way. It's complicated.
But they were with you.
Yeah, there.
Was
yeah.
it then?
Yeah, that's true. It would have been nice to that they would be there, but that's fine. It's not like I didn't want them.
No,
I really don't think I didn't want them to be there. And actually, she has told that she would like to. She always says she would like to come to. Retreat. I suggested she might go to Coimbra, not this year because it's my son's birthday when I'm at the retreat, which is a bit complicated, but Coimbra would be easier because it's not so far.
Mm.
It's just the weekend, she could stay like just for the weekend. Yeah.
Mm. But yeah. Well, this turned into quite an animated discussion, starting from one little question, which was...
Not solitary.
No, what I meant was, you know, just like a question. And it's always much more interesting when there's questions than when I just talk.
It's interesting because in the beginning I didn't tell my... parents-in-law that I went to meditation when I asked them for help, you know. I did not tell it. I told I'll go with friends to Normandy in the first year at least. And then I think when we went to the other place in Normandy, the Zurich. I think there I thought for the first time, like, why don't I just tell it, you know, it would be so much easier because it's not, there are questions afterwards, so did you enjoy it and whatever. And
Fabrice didn't tell them?
No. But then at some point I just said, like, oh good, I'm in a meditation room and we'll have 1 week of meditation and then it was that and there were no further questions. But I think I was yeah, and some feel of some this judgmental, you know,
sure.
meditation stuff.
mm-hmm.
And then at some point I just didn't care anymore. I thought if they want to know more, they can ask me. If not, it's, I just don't care.
mm-hmm.
They may have their ideas about it.
Mm.
Not important.
mm-hmm.
And it's much easier. So. No, like, because if not, it would be a little bit weird if I say I go to Paris tomorrow, but I leave at 8:30. I'll see friends, but I leave at 8:30.
Can't be late. Yeah, it often has to do with, in fact, it does have to do with our own feeling about it or our own, you know. I used to use it as an excuse with my colleagues of not telling them because I always thought, well, you know, I'm supposed to be a journalist and, you know, the ethical guidelines of an Anglo-Saxon journalist are you're not supposed to have positions on anything, you're supposed to be completely objective, and that if I was saying I was doing this Zen Buddhist thing, then I would be taking a position and, you know, I'm not supposed to be, whatever. So I always use that as an excuse for not doing it, to telling them. But I still could have said I was doing meditation and not said it's Zen.
Yeah, so for me it was the same in my scientific, in the workplace, you know. I just once told one colleague with whom I did experience and talked about it. And then he said, oh, I'm doing meditation too. And I didn't tell my boss, who was thinking of... She just once said on Mathieu Ricard, who was a scientist, yeah, he did some pretty interesting stuff before he turned into a scientist. Not only the science comes, but I didn't tell anyone. And now I'm... My former, the boss of the equipment, he also is doing meditation now. With him, at some point I told him, I think, meditation is, oh, I'm doing that too now, in a group of whatever, in university.
But it's interesting because if you think, so, you know, you have colleagues who probably go to church. You know, there's probably...
But it
wouldn't be, you know... Or you have friends who go to church or go to...
That's weird.
What?
That's weird.
It could be. But you wouldn't have the same reaction of challenging them. Why do you... So what do you go there for? It could be, but it's not bizarre in the same way. It's kind of... You wouldn't, like, challenge them and say, well, why are you doing that? Or that's, you know...
Mm.
I wouldn't, but... and I don't really know people who would... You know, it's like, okay, so fine, you go to the church, you send your kids to catechism or whatever, you know. Okay, that's your choice, it's fine, because that's what you want to do on Sunday, or, you know.
It's still seen as the main thing and the serious thing, so it's okay to know that people go to.
Right, we can have opinions about it. And
in this context here, of course, or in Portugal.
Yeah, I think it's even less acceptable here than in Portugal. Yeah, here it's kind of...
Meditation?
People going to Catholic church or something.
Ah.
You know.
Mais hier, je parlais avec une femme qui est psychiatre et qui fait une psychanalyse. Et autant, il y a 20 ou 30 ans, pratiquement tous les psychiatres faisaient une psychanalyse, autant maintenant, non. Et elle n'ose pas dire à ses collègues psychiatres qu'elle fait une psychanalyse, elle serait prise pour une...
Ouais.
Ou trop de faiblesse, ou... Enfin, je sais pas.
Mm. Qu'est-ce que c'est que ce truc ésotérique
Et c'est fou, hein. Même la psychanalyse.
Ouais.
Donc, bon, voilà, ça rejoint ce que tu dis.
Ouais. It's almost 6? Oh, I thought we were stopping at 5. Ooh, okay, somebody should have told me.
I thought you had a watch there and you were keeping an eye on it.
I thought if nobody was reacting to this in passing.
Okay, fine. I didn't know. I should tell people to keep the time. Okay, thank you. Can we just do the...